You are listening to the Smart Betting Club podcast with me, your host, Peter Ling. For the very latest on what it takes to make your betting profitable, including the experts you should follow, please visit the SBC website at smartbettingclub.com. Hello and welcome to this, the very first Smart Betting Club podcast. Over the course of this new series, I will be speaking to several different winning punters and professional tipsters on how they make a profit betting and what lessons we can take from them for our own betting journey. So I'm delighted to say for today's inaugural podcast, I'm joined by Tom Brownlee from the bookiebashing.net website. Welcome to the podcast, Tom.
Pete, how are you doing?
I'm very well. Like I say, I'm delighted to have you on for today's first podcast because I think some of the topics we're going to get into today, I haven't heard covered elsewhere. And we're going to get onto things like betting in bookmaker shops, some of the offers that you're able to take advantage of. Yeah, so they're really looking forward to today's chat. But I thought to kickstart things, would it be good if you could just introduce yourself a little bit and, you know, what it is you do at Bookie Bashing?
Sure, right. So I think I classify myself as a professional failure in life. I've never really stuck at anything too long to become really good at it. I did a PhD in applied statistics and in decision making, but I got as far as my Viva. I didn't do the corrections. I tried a career out and I got to senior management, but then my children were born. And so I didn't stick that out because I didn't want to just sit in an office from 8 a.m. till 6 p.m. watching them get older. I tried to be a stay-at-home dad, but then lockdown happened. And I don't know if you've ever watched Peppa Pig, but
yes, a lot.
People wrote and produced that. They need a firing squad would be too good for them. Unfortunately, I'm done with Peppa Pig and the full-time dad stuff. The one thing that we've got going in the background and the reason I've been able to jump around a lot is bookiebashing.net is sort of just a community of advantage players. A small few of us have been around for the better part of a decade, just, you know, making as much money as we can from bookmakers in the background. And we've grown from just a group of pals a decade ago to a couple hundred people now. And under the umbrella of advantage play at a bookmaker, it's essentially anything where you've got an edge over them long term. And that's what we do. We primarily focus on football coupons in shops, some other complicated type bets in shops, golf betting. I've been putting together a few models for the darts recently because the darts Premier League has been on every single night. And when something is on iteratively every night, it focuses your mind to look at it. And we are doing things a lot with darts just now. The one thing that we're not doing is tennis because I never really figured out where the edges are in tennis. And the US Open is on just now, so I'm watching that in the background. So those are sort of the main areas that we're focused on just now.
Yeah, like I say, there's a heck of a lot that's going on at Bookie Bashing. And, you know, how you've grown that community is fascinating. But what is it that made you get into betting? Because obviously, reading some of the literature on your website, you and other members of the team there, you know, you have degrees, obviously opportunities to go into the traditional world and get more traditional careers there. But what is it that attracted you in particular to betting?
Well, so I started off with poker in the early 2000s, where there was the online poker boom. There was one very, very simple trick. And that was if you woke up early on a Sunday, you'd be playing against Americans who were still up. And if they were still up at 4 a.m. American time, it meant that they'd had a few to drink. And it was extremely easy to play ABC poker against them and pay for my university tuition fees, right? Mm-hmm. And the skills I learned there, I was able to go and play some local tournaments, did very well. I'd started going over to Las Vegas. I did quite well in Las Vegas. But it never seemed to be something that I was too keen on putting a huge amount of hours in. In fact, one of the main problems I had was not the analytical side, the mathematics or anything like that. It was trying to gauge at what point of a tournament to have my first beer. Because, for example, a poker tournament could be 12, 14 hours long, the main event of the WSOP. With about 6 hours to go, I'd be looking at my chips and think, right, I think I'm going to make the next day. It's time for a beer. And unfortunately, that would affect the decision-making that came along later. So poker career never really took off for me. But sports betting and poker just seem to be completely entwined in terms of how you approach it. You either have good decisions or bad decisions. Things are either long-term positive equity or negative equity. And I think the key takeaway from poker is that you can place a number of sports bets. And as long as the decision-making that had gone into the bet that you're placing is sound, then the results don't matter. And the same in poker. As long as your decision-making is okay, it doesn't matter if you got unlucky on the flop or the person had a hand that they really shouldn't have had. Long-term is what you've got to be looking at. So the poker really drove in to sports betting, and we were able to eke out quite a lot of money doing football coupons in the early 2010s. And I don't mind sharing the secret. It's not difficult. It was betting on steamers and putting them into doubles, trebles, lucky 15s. My theory here being, you know, I have a rough knowledge about football, but I'm not an expert. I have a rough idea of analytics, but I'm definitely not an expert in coming up with probability, odds, things like that. And I've got a rough idea how to get on, which is always the difficult bit with restrictions and so on and so forth. And if you combine those three together, it's just enough information. But I'll never know, for example, the Benfica reserves team have got a youth player coming up and he starts in the first team and that causes the price to come in. I don't know enough about Benfica's reserve team to be at the front of the queue there. But what I can do is I can witness the fact that the price is steaming in on various tools. There's more than one way to skin a cat in terms of trying to determine where the steamers are coming from. And if I'm always betting on teams whose prices are shortening at the time that I am betting on them, then that is indicative of some information in the long run. And we applied that theory to placing coupon bets and just did very well, to the point that the very first days of bookie bashing was mostly just centered around how do we go about building a community of people that would want to collect these coupons and have a feedback mechanism of when a team was cut and so on and so forth. So that was how we got into it all those years ago.
And it's fascinating because, yeah, I do come across several people who perhaps started in the poker world because so many of the, yeah, I guess, the value betting ethos aligns, whether it's poker, whether it's, you know, betting on football or golf or whatever it might be. So it's no surprise to hear, you know, of your poker background there. So talking about the coupons, so they're still a major part of what you oversee at Bookie Bashing. Is that right at the moment?
Yeah, they got a lot harder around about 2017, 2018. I think that was with the rise of, there was a number of arbitrage sites that provided tools that would allow people to go along and see the teams that were a higher price than the exchange. And all of a sudden, instead of a sort of reasonable bankroll managed value bet, these guys were getting as much as they possibly could, maximum stakes on these teams within a few seconds of them becoming opportunities. And that at that time really closed the net away from some of the initial value that we were able to get. Certainly the concept of betting on singles, betting on anything that would traditionally be against a very liquid market on the exchange, the big premiership teams, so on and so forth, those opportunities went away. But with that, we expanded away and we sort of set some new rules. Let's only bet when we're betting at trebles and higher, because things like that, well, they can be hedged, but they're very difficult to. So the arbitrage players haven't necessarily spoiled the pool of value there. And also we would look at more complex markets where we're taking, say, match odds and both teams to score. We're trying to sort of sit back and calculate that from first principles ourselves. And we can find value in a market like that when the exchange markets are usually empty or not even available. So it's a similar kind of concept. It's a little bit harder, but just because it's harder doesn't make it any less fun or any more valuable an opportunity. The only difficulty we've had recently is there's been very little on in the last 2 weeks. And betting on the French national can be a little bit frustrating given that they tend to score 1.1 goals per match or whatever it is. So it's been a bit dry recently.
Yeah, and that's all going to change very soon. You know, we're recording this now at the first week of September, but you know, next weekend the Premier League's back, we've got the NFL starting and all kinds of leagues and sports returning. So
are you kidding me? The NFL and the Premiership on at the same weekend and the rest of the football leagues. I've penciled in next week to be an extremely busy week, that is for sure.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing all the opportunities that come up in the next few weeks, certainly. And we're talking about coupons here, and we're talking about betting in shops. And I referenced this at the top of the podcast. And a large proportion of what you offer is dedicated to the idea of physically placing a bet in a bookmaker shops. And obviously you do coupons, but what's the advantage, if you like, of betting in a shop compared to betting online? You know, obviously perhaps you can get on a lot bit easier, but yeah, maybe restrictions start to bite in a different way because you're physically dealing with a person. What are the advantages of betting in shops?
I don't understand why shops are still a thing, because the only reason for shops to exist is either to serve a customer who doesn't have an online account. And there are really not very many people like that anymore. Even, you know, your 70-year-olds and your 75-year-olds, people are showing them how to open online accounts. Or they've been restricted online, which means why would the bookmaker want to lay those people bets? Heaven knows. But they fortunately do still exist. The reasons why they're used, prices are held generally a little bit longer in shops than they are online. Until the day that you can get from one shop to the next faster than the speed of light, there's always going to be more people watching out for opportunities online than there are going to be in shops. And that means that prices can be held. One of my favorite concessions to bet on is the Double Delight Hat-Trick Heaven at Betfred. I find it a lot of fun, sort of determining this is if you bet on the first goal scorer and he gets a second goal in the match, Fred will double your odds and triple your odds if he gets a hat-trick. And we found that prices can be cut online and held in shop for an hour up to kickoff after they've been cut online, simply because the footfall isn't there of people running to the shop, whereas there are millions of people looking online waiting to find out that Aubameyang is starting up front without Lacazette. And that means that his chances of getting the first goal have just increased exponentially. So prices are held longer. Restrictions are usually slower. I mean, most, if not all, cashier staff up and down the country are simply lovely and couldn't care less about who it is that is coming in, as long as you're not an arbitrage player, because they are trained to look out for the arbitrage players. And as long as it can be proven that that's not what you're up to, staying away from the singles in the match odd markets and things like that, then the only thing that they are trained to do is they're trained to sort of report upwards people that are turning up multiple times and collecting very large wins. And that particular problem can be solved just by sliding them a fiver or a tenner as a tip. You make their life a lot better, you feel better yourself, but more importantly, they're much less incentivized to be reporting upwards who it is that's come in to collect the 500 or £1,000. The stakes in shops are generally higher than they are online, and certain bets and coupons are only available in shop. And in terms of that, there's one particular sort of set of bets called the William Hill Great Sports Offers. There, William Hill shops have a screen with buttons 1 to 25 on them. And these bets, they've been around for the best part of a decade. They're moderately complex to work out. They're things like, you know, tonight it would be Scotland to score in both halves and take over three corners in both halves. Not the kind of thing that you could really precisely estimate when you're stood in shop, but we've sort of developed this network of people that can go out, find out exactly what that intel is, feed it back to Bookie Bashing, and then we'll quickly run through all of them sort of from HQ and identify which ones are good and which ones are bad. And then don't forget, when you get restricted online, the very common thing for a lot of people to do is to go and get their mum and ask them to start placing bets online for them. That particular strategy has a finite life. And for me, I'm not too interested in doing that. I'm restricted almost everywhere online, apart from exchanges and a couple of bookmakers that will actually lay a bet when you bet fairly with them. But in shops, there's nothing particularly wrong with having two or three mates and you all get together and form a team. And when a bet is an opportunity, you sort of send out an instruction. And if any of them are free or passing that particular shop, you can go in, place a bet, and you all share the liability there. And by working in a team there, you maximize the amount of money that you can get down, but you also sort of flatten the risk that you're exposed to as well. And generally, to me, it just makes it a little bit more easy to make larger sums of money betting in shops than it ever has been online.
Oh, that's fascinating. That absolutely is fascinating, because I imagine there's many people who in the UK or Ireland where we have this huge number of shops, this clustering of shops often in the same small provincial towns. You'll have multiple shops from the same bookmaker. And so that obviously provides the opportunity to go into one shop and then maybe other people that you may know, or even if it's just yourself, going into different shops, but the same bookmaker and taking advantage. But do you have to be tactical about it?
The dream, the real dream, is that they've got these SSBT self-service betting terminals. They are managed by a private company, but they're available in Betfred, Ladbrokes, Coral and Paddy Power. And they've all got exactly the same odds on them. And if you can find a value proposition on there, you can go into a Betfred, walk out, walk into a Coral, walk out, walk into a Paddy Power. And those companies don't talk to each other. So they're not going to phone them up and go, Tom is going and putting a maximum stake on this particular proposition. And that allows you just to have that little bit of an extra edge. William Hill do manage their own. But again, the anonymity that those things provide gives you a real edge. It does.
Absolutely, because I imagine, you know, bookmakers are looking to cut costs wherever they can. If that means they need less staff to kind of sit in the bookmaker shop and take your bet, then that's good for them. But obviously, on the flip side, it presents that opportunity. Absolutely. And, you know, just in terms of practically doing it, if somebody listening to this, would they be able to do it? Maybe they don't have a team of people, but by themselves, just start to go into some shops and start to take some of these coupons, take some of these bets themselves. And if they were to do that, then do they have to be careful about if they make a big win one day, or they don't go into the same shop too regularly? Or is it just a matter of you've got an interest in FAQ on shop tactics and how to kind of, you know, make sure that you, from writing the bet correctly, because they can be fussy about that on winners. But obviously, like you said, they're tipping, or maybe even buying them some coffee and donuts. So what would you suggest to somebody listening to this and some of the basic principles to start off with betting in shops?
Oh, right. Yeah. I mean, the basic rule is that if you're a jerk, you need to sort out being a jerk before you go and bet on shops, because you do see people that shuffle in looking at their feet, whether they're a jerk or whether they just don't have any confidence. They just seem like they stand out a mile, very nervous, and they go up to the counter and then they try and have £200 and 20-1 on their being over 45 goals in the Belgium third division this evening. And of course, they're going to get knocked back. They're going to look suspicious. And there's a whole metagame part of the betting that it doesn't need to be that unpleasant. And part of it is that if you want to be sort of continuing to get on at large stakes in your local shop, make sure you know the staff first. And if you don't know the staff, go in, say hello, introduce yourself, place a couple of bets. And then maybe the next time you go in, why don't you bring in a tray of Starbucks coffees with you and ask if they want one. Say, I thought you guys looked thirsty and busy in here, so here's a Starbucks coffee. Get to know them by name. And then slowly but surely, you're betting £50, £100, £200. And then you might trigger what is known as the PTL limits, the permission to lay limits. They have a little chart behind the counter that tells them at what point they have to phone up and get permission to lay your bet. And an example being that down in Betfred, you can get up to £300 on a football coupon before they phone up and ask the traders if you're allowed to get that. And generally, there isn't a problem phoning up the traders and getting permission, but you would rather be anonymous, not have the eye in the sky look at you from bookmaker HQ. So if you are familiar with the cashier behind the counter, she'll turn around and go, well, the limit's £300. And then you go, okay, I'm going to have £295 on it instead. And then you don't have to phone up. Those kind of advantages can just keep you betting for a little bit longer. Or again, if the staff like you, then you could be betting for years on plus EV value propositions without facing any restrictions. Or if you are going to face restrictions, you kind of get warned about it. One of the interesting ones is we had 3 winners in 3 weeks on the PGA Tour on the golf through January into early February. And they were at exactly the same shop, which was frustrating because I was placing bets at multiple shops. And my pal from university from 15 years ago, he went into the shop on the third week to collect, it was £6,000. It was 5,000 for the win, 1,000 for the place, 6,000 for the third time in 3 weeks, and was informed by the girl, we've had a notice from head office that we're not allowed to accept any more bets from you. That's not any more golf bets. That's any more bets of any kind. And then she whispered in his ear, she said, I'm really sorry to tell you that because I like you as a person. I don't think you're doing anything wrong. And between you and me, it's only applicable to this shop. And if you just go to the shop in the next town, you'll be absolutely fine. And it's that kind of rapport with the staff that maintains the longevity and allows you to keep on going on. Whereas, you know, if that was online, the traders look at your account, they say, no, you're limited to pennies, and that's it then, you know, that's it forever. And your ability to continue is put to an end at that point. And that's the real key difference between online and shops.
It's very similar to the logic you need to apply when betting online. If you went in and had £200 on a horse at 20 to 1, because they were top priced, and you continue to do that, take that kind of tactic, and you're making a little bit of cash potentially, you're going to face problems. So
I think the difference is there's no bounce back online. I've said this to you before, P. I think Sky Better, if you get restricted and then your betting patterns when restricted are indicative of somebody that's willing to play the game a little bit, you can see that your limits do increase from that 0.1% restricted account. But they are the exception. I haven't seen another bookmaker do that. And it's the finality of Bet365 and Betfred turning around to you and going, no more, that restricts and is the disadvantage of online against shops.
Yeah. So obviously you've got this nuance when you go into the shops, you know, where if you get the trading decision from, you know, your betting account closed online, it's just an email and it's the trading decision. Whereas obviously an example, and you just go to the next shop, or maybe if you wine and dine the staff a little bit more, you know, you might get, they might get a little bit of leeway and leverage with them.
Or lay low for 6 months if you've had a very big win.
Yeah.
You know, I had a one of the pushers coupons. It was the third round of the FA Cup last year, 2019. And I went to watch the rugby, Worcester versus Bath. There was a Betfred just down the road from there. So we popped in and I placed the pushers coupon on the FA Cup third round. And at that time, it was the underdogs were steaming into a really high prices, 5 to 1, 10 to 1, 20 to 1. And when you put these in trebles, it suddenly makes an enormous coupon. Mm. And I think 6 out of the 17s won for £15,000, which is an extremely large win on a single football coupon. And when I went down there, there was quite a lot of attention in getting that money paid out. And even though it's quite a convenient shop for me, I'd completely made the decision that I need to give that shop a rest for about 6 months, perhaps maybe a year, until they've had a rotation of staff, or one way or another, they've forgotten me. Because if I turn up the very next week and start placing £200-300 football coupon bets, it's not going to be long until it won't even be their decision. It will be the eye in the sky. It'll be headquarters. It'll be a trader or a senior manager who will turn around and go, that guy that came in, now we're not taking any more of his bets.
Yeah, enough time to grow a beard or to disguise yourself.
Yeah. Get a long coat and some sunglasses.
Yeah, exactly. So obviously you're talking about some big wins there. Do you mind sharing, you know, some of the big wins or the biggest wins you've had with some of these coupons?
Generally the coupons, and they're extremely volatile, mm-hmm. right? Because you're betting in trebles, and generally as well, if you're betting on match odds and both teams to score, team to win to nil, or team to win and over 2 goals in the game, you are talking about evens or higher. So any treble will be 8-1, 9-1, 10-1, 100-1. Something like that. So there was that particular weekend, I plucked it out. It was very memorable, that FA Cup third round, because Oldham won at 20-1 and Rochdale won at 10-1 on the same coupon. So you've got two winners there. You multiply the 20-1 by the 10-1. That's 300-1 times any other team that wins on the coupon. Now, whilst that sounds a lot of fun, there's a lot of losing that gets to that point. The volatility. You have to sort of go with the concept that smart money is correct a lot of the time, and we're compounding value. But even so, the 20-1 isn't going to win that often, and we're going to have to go through very long periods of losing. Generally, maybe 7 or 8 weeks of losing, and then one big week of winning, and then 7 or 8 weeks of losing. That weekend, we took the third round of the FA Cup in total for about £35,000, with £15,000 coming off the single coupon. But over the entire season, we only took football coupons for £80,000. Almost half of it came from the third round of the FA Cup. And total, the quantity of coupons to get to that amount of money, we're talking about maybe 10 to 20 coupons a week. Various different shops, various different markets, and about £200-300 per coupon. The majority of which return nothing, and a lot of them return sort of, you know, if only one treble in the coupon wins, you've got 35 trebles down, you're going to have lost the majority of your £200-300. So the big win really that stands out is the FA Cup third round in 2019. That'll stay with me.
Yeah, that's a huge win. But obviously, like you say, it's you must have built up to that kind of staking level, and it comes down to things like bankroll management and then just kind of consistently putting the coupons in, you know, 10 to 20 a week, as you say, just keep grinding through them and just know that you are taking shrewd bets. You are, and over time, you know, the dice will fall in your favor and you'll have that, the big payout. But it takes so much with betting, I find, is just discipline, consistency, you know, not worrying too much about the lows and not getting too high when you get the big wins and just looking at that bigger picture. So,
and keep records as well, especially when you're betting on volatile. I think it's the same as kind of if you're betting at 50 to 1 horses. You need to keep records because the one time that you win, that period of happiness, glee and delight, thinking that you're getting one over, is drowned out by long periods of losing. And if you're not keeping records, and I know a couple of people that don't keep records and sort of they think they're winning only because there's money in their bank account, but they don't know how much they're winning. Personally, I couldn't do it, not because I don't trust that I'm winning or losing, but because I feel like when I'm going through very long losing periods, it's at that point that the records need to come out and I need to look at them and I need to make sure, okay, I haven't had a win in 8 weeks, but it's okay because over however many weeks or whatever larger sample size, that variance is flattening out and we are ending up where we should be, which is up overall.
And also I fully advocate the idea of record keeping, but I also find it very interesting and useful because if you ever worry, is your edge diminishing? Are these bets no longer plus EV? Do you have to be careful with that? Because obviously markets evolve, the bets you take evolve. So unless you have a record, how can you gauge that? How can you look at the performance, see it in its context of what it's achieved historically? And if you still feel confident, if you, especially if you're staking large sums of money and able to win large sums of money, it's very important that you have that confidence level. And just to round off on shops, because we're getting onto the multiples here, how have you seen it change at all, you know, in this COVID world and whereby people trying to restrict as much face-to-face contact? And you've got, like you say, you've got these betting shops. You don't know why they exist. Well, they exist because of the FOB tees and how much money they were making. Is that changing now? Have you seen much change? Have you seen some close, or are you seeing less people within them? Because realistically, thinking about it, why would you need bookmaker shops when you can just do it all online and then reduce the fear of contracting coronavirus?
It comes down to one thing, I think, and that's looking at what gambling is as a hobby, as a leisure pursuit. If you go over to the big casinos in America, the bookmakers in Las Vegas, they're these grand open spaces with leather seats and pine furniture, and waitresses come over and they bring you drinks. Now, I don't know about you, but my local Corrals isn't exactly like that. But it is somewhere where the generally older gentlemen, I mean, the average person that visits a bookmaker's shop is probably 70, 75 years old. He goes down there for some company. And he goes down there, even if he's not talking to someone, he's sat around with other people his age and they're putting a couple of quid in the virtuals or whatever. And it's a social interaction that they're partaking of. And whilst that is necessary, it's never going to go away. You're not going to be able to replace that online. Even British casinos, there is a certain demise around the casinos in Britain just now with the intake that they're taking going down because it's not a cultural thing. I think as a new generation of people are coming through, they're seeing gambling less and less of a leisure pursuit and something that is fun and more perhaps something that they shouldn't be spending their very, very limited, hard-earned money and wages with at the end of the month. So if we've got no casinos and online gambling isn't providing any social satisfaction, I think we'll always have the local bookmakers to cater for people that want to go down, stick 2 quid in the dogs and talk to their neighbour about whatever it is that they're in the news that day.
Absolutely, yeah. So it goes also to the idea that you need to try and blend in as best you can because, you know, unless you fit into the demographic of the people you've explained there, 70 to 75 year old and placing the small bets here and there, you know, you're going to stand out. So it's obviously very important to utilize the tactics we outlined before.
As an advanced player in shop, there's nothing you can do to prevent yourself from standing out, I'm afraid, because there's no simple way of getting a few hundred quid down when the majority of the shop customers are £2 or £3 people. So
yeah, so making sure you bring those Starbucks coffees in is essential. I also wanted to get onto some of the online, well, obviously you can do some of this offline on your golf tracker, because that's been the focal point of a Smart Betting Club review recently. We've been exploring this angle of your service for quite some time, and that helped us develop this detailed review. And perhaps you'd just like to explain the logic behind the golf tracker, and you're using, you know, another value mechanism to kind of generate some of the value selections you're picking out. But could you just get into that and a little bit about how it works and picks out value?
Sure. Well, I'm looking at the Andalusia Masters just now in Valderrama in Spain. I do want to know what they've put in the tee of the greensmen down in Valderrama, because only four players out of 127 are under par just now. I'm on one of them, Pablo Larrazabal, who is 100-1, although don't count your chickens after 15 holes of round two in golf, for sure. And then you've got guys like Hao Tong Li, who quit after being five over three holes into the first round. I think he's turned around and went, I'm not having any of this. The variance that is involved in golf betting, especially when they set up courses this hard, is fascinating. It's definitely a high-risk game. I think the favorite in the Andalusia Masters was 18-1. And when you're betting when the favorite is 18-1 and the field is 100, 200, 300, 400-1, it starts to take on a slightly different mathematical puzzle than Scotland to score in both halves tonight and to get over three corners, which is really sort of black and white. There's a fair odds number for that, or there isn't. In terms of golf, the puzzle is a lot more incomplete. But take a step back and have a think about what's going on, especially a perfect example, not the Andalusia, but the Tour Championship tonight. This is a tournament with the 30 best players in the world, and it's a handicap head start for whoever's got the most FedEx points this year. Dustin Johnson starts 10 under. In 30th place, Billy Horschel, Cameron Champ, Mackenzie Hughes, Victor Hovland, Cameron Smith, those guys all start at evens, 10 shots behind Dustin Johnson. Are they going to win? No. And that's why they're 500-1, 1,000-1, 750-1. These guys don't have a chance of winning. Do they have a chance of coming fourth or fifth? Absolutely they do, because they're only four or five shots away from fourth or fifth. And being in the top 30 FedEx points players this year, they're all capable of catching fire and shooting significantly under par relative to the rest of the field. Yet we're getting 500-1 on some of these guys. The place part at 500-1, 1-5 odds, is 100-1. And I'm telling you now, Billy Horschel and Cameron Champ, they're not going to finish in the places less frequently than 100-1. So this is all about trying to find out where there is bias in the places. The model is constructed around that. The difficulty, especially recently, is that almost every bookmaker has their own unique set of terms. We could be at 1-4 or 1-5. The days of 1-3 are long, long gone. And we could be four places, five places, six places, seven places, eight places, nine places. We built a model that would consider up to 10 places. So, of course, after lockdown, Skybet went 11 places just to get us scrambling into the code and the algorithms of the tracker to try and figure out what the probability of that would be. And the mathematical problem is quite simple. It's like you work out, take Billy Horschel, what are the chances of him coming second, third, fourth, and fifth and winning it? And then add all of that up, and we've got his top five probability. And because we've got an estimate, an exact figure, an exact number that we think Billy Horschel should be, he should be 1 in 60 times, 1 in 70 times, whatever, we can then compare that against the bookmaker's odds. And it's a simple yes, no. In fact, it's not even a yes, no. It's what is the percentage above the bookmaker's odds that we're betting here? Anything over 100% is a long-term plus EV proposition. Anything under 100%, you're losing your money if you put it down on them. So let's just bet on the guys over 100%. In this particular Tour Championship, the way it's set up with Dustin Johnson, who is 2-1 or 15-8 or something like that, it's almost like a filthy each way race in horse racing. Almost everyone whose name is not Dustin Johnson is plus EV in this field. And I'm actually now on half the field, which could be extremely expensive if Dustin wins it and a few of the favorites come second, third, and fourth. But it will be also extremely lucrative if I can fill up the places with some of the guys at the back of the field. So that's the theory behind it.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you talk about this tournament, because I did a little look at what happened last year. And I think Justin Thomas was in the Dustin Johnson, the 10 under, with the starting point, and he finished fourth. I don't know if there's the same rules last year, but it's very interesting, because there's a couple, I think Paul Casey, who finished fifth, and he was only at a handicap of 200. So again, we're talking maybe might not get Billy Horschel to finish in those in the places because he's a little bit further back. But it just illustrates that, yeah, you often may find one or two that are 100 to 1 place, a little bit lower potentially, that can bring a little bit of place value. And presumably, maybe not this week, but on a general tournament, you'll get those that will actually go and win the tournament. And it seems to me that's a lot of golf betting. You know, it's 2 months of very frustrated Sundays and then the occasional eureka moment.
Yeah. All the value being with the outsiders, mainly.
Yes.
Let me tell you as well, last year in the Tour Championship, that particular tournament, Rory McIlroy won that. He was 10 to 1. I was at a local music festival and I happened to be with all my team that were on that particular bet. And we had £1,000 each way on Rory McIlroy shared equally amongst all of us. And we were watching a band called The Feeling. It was not a drum and bass festival. This was a family friendly sort of cheesy pop festival for the kids. And they've got that song Rosé, which is kind of like a slow ballad. And we were listening to that as Rory McIlroy put his putt in to go 13 under and win the tournament and make us all a bit 10 grand richer. And we had our arms linked around each other, drinking cider in the sunshine, singing Rory to the song Rosé. And it was brilliant. It really was. It was a lot of fun.
That sounds fantastic. Yes. I know you had the big winner on Mark Warren in early July, and I was I had a bet on him. A couple of sources picked him up, you know, yourselves, I think, and a couple of tipsters.
That was mad, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I don't know why either. I saw him everywhere. It was crazy, and he was value on our track as well. I couldn't explain why.
No, well, that's the thing. Obviously, the price went in. You know, this is a guy who win or come last. I think the week prior to that or week subsequent to it, you know, he missed the cut completely. He was perhaps, he did the, you know, Mark Leishman role. Yeah. You're looking at his score thinking, I could probably beat him. So it's just fascinating. And I remember the same for me. You know, I was out and I had a bet on him and then my phone buzzed and just telling me the tournament had ended and he'd won. I was like, oh, that's fantastic. I was out the park with my daughter. So it's just fascinating how you've, you know, as a professional bettor, you can be in all these locations or you're taking a tactical trip to the bathroom to check the live scores when you're out for dinner.
I'll tell you why that was fun as well, because I'm normally on about, so I prefer to get on about 8-15% of the field in terms of win probability. I was only on 2% of that field because I couldn't find the value. Mm-hmm. So it was one of the longest shots that I'd had, and he was 125 to 1 from memory. And it was the most unexpected win from Mark Warren in that tournament.
And sometimes that's the way it works, isn't it, with this kind of strategy? You are, again, we're going into the consistency of just placing those bets week in, week out, not living it out too much. It's very easy with golf to get excited day two, day three, even on the final day when pressure really starts to kick in and we see how different golfers react to that. And I can think of quite a few bad beats, and I'm sure you can think of more, where I think, oh, I had that in the bag. You know, it was trading heavily odds on in play where your guy loses it on the 18th. Billy Horschel being one recently, who I thought was nailed on, but and then gets beat by a 500 to 1 shot. And it is that, isn't it? It is that kind of consistency and just letting everything take its place and then doing it for a long enough period of time for the edge to manifest itself and to variance to run out. Mm-hmm. And to actually see, you know, you'll have some of those stories hopefully where your big bet on Rory or Mark Warren actually comes in and that patience is rewarded.
Yeah. It would be nice if they moved it away from Sunday nights, though, because either I stay up way too late on a Sunday night to try and find the end. And if your guy's in a playoff and then he loses the playoff at 2:30 in the morning and you had all your hopes until then, you go to sleep completely down in the dumps. Or on the flip side of the coin, if you wake up on a Monday morning and see your guy lost in a playoff, you're like, oh, what a great way to start the week this is, you know? So I think I could do with it if they just had golf tournaments on the East Coast of America or in Europe. That would be much better.
Absolutely. But the European Tour, I was talking to another golf tipster recently and he was saying he finds there's better value on the European Tour just because there's less known about it. There's more variance in terms of the performance of the players. Have you found that? Or you found obviously the PGA is a little bit more difficult to profit from? Or do you find actually it's more profitable because the bookmakers are offering better terms very often on the PGA to incentivize you to bet with them?
Sure. I was talking to an old trader who he was kindly taking me through all the different analytical models that are used by the different bookmakers and the guys setting the odds. And for starters, they're nowhere near as complicated as you think that they should be. In fact, if you've got a sort of basic comprehension of statistics and availability of data, it's nothing that anyone couldn't have a go at themselves. But in terms of the European tour, there is quite simply less data available both to traders and to the amateur advantage player. And because of that, there is more fingers in the air, more volatility, less certainty. In terms of my own records, for some reason, I've done better on the PGA than the European Tour, but the logic would suggest the other way around. The logic would suggest that because there's less certainty in the European Tour, that probably should mean that the favorites are less favorite and the underdogs are less underdoggy, and there should be a little bit more of an edge in the player's favor. I've probably done better on PGA over the European Tour simply because it would take decades and decades before there would be a sample size that was large enough for those particular edges to come to fruition.
Oh, that makes sense. And we talked earlier on, I wanted to get onto a little bit about the psychology of betting, because we talked a little on about record keeping, and we're talking about some of the big odds selections that you put on the coupons and again on the golf. But is there anything else that helps you deal with the good and the bad runs? Do you, for example, watch these events live or bets live, or do you have that many that you can't? Do you find it easier to switch off or just look at the results on when they've finished, the tournament's finished or the race is finished or whatever it might be? Or do you watch it live? What are the tactics and things that you do to help yourself navigate it, especially when you're having a bad run of form?
Well, first and foremost, I'm a sports fan. That does make watching it easier. Saying that, I'm also a family man, and you've got to have that balance, especially if you're betting professionally to cover the mortgage and the kids' shoes. And you can't simply, in terms of a balanced family life, constantly have the darts, the football and everything on in the background, unless you've got a particularly understanding five-year-old daughter who doesn't mind, and I don't. In terms of taking a step back and understanding the decisions that you're making, there are kind of five or six different components. None of them are essential to forming a long-term winner, but if you don't have at least a few of them, then there's not going to be much hope for you. It's all well and good understanding the mathematics, but you've got to be very analytical. You've got to simply look at a price and know whether that price is good or not, and know where the line could be. Oh, he's been cut from 66 to 1 to 60 to 1. You do need to know if the 60 to 1 is still good. That level of analytics is important. Having the knowledge on sports is important. One of my pals walked into a shop one time, tried to bet on Sergio Ramos to score the first goal on a particular day in La Liga. And the person behind the counter asked him how long he'd been a fan of Real Madrid for. And he couldn't have even told you what country Real Madrid played football in. He was that sort of, you know, he didn't pick up on the fact that the second word of the team is Madrid, and he was taken aback, and it wasn't helping him. So if you've got both the sports knowledge and the analytical knowledge, that can be kept combined with how to get on and where to look at for angles. In terms of if you're restricted online, you've got to go into the shops and find out where, and then have those relatively sort of big kahunas that to know that you need to be betting more when you have an edge. And if you can combine all of those things and then sit down and look at your spreadsheet and see that you're going on a losing run, you turn to yourself and go, you know, I know where to look, I know how to look, I know about the sports, I know the decisions that I was making were right. I had the kahunas to go big when the opportunity was available to me. I couldn't have done much more then. I know I lost, but all the decisions that I made were correct. Whereas on the flip side of the coin, and this is really difficult to do, but you got to do it. Sometimes you might take a punt and it wins, and then you look back on it and you realize, do you know what? That all the decision-making that went into that bet was wrong. And if I could have my time again, I wouldn't make that bet, despite the fact that it returned me a couple of hundred quid or whatever it is. You know, so it's that honesty when you're reviewing and looking back at the decisions that you made to tell yourself, okay, that is a reasonable strategy, or that is not an unreasonable strategy. And I always define it as, if you could turn all of your decision-making into a few lines of code in Microsoft Excel and just run Microsoft Excel, there it goes. It's the TOM model is running there. It's finding the bets, it's placing the bets, and it's holding on to the bankroll, and it's doing everything. And at no point is it stopping and looking at that run of bad performances, or, you know, a month-long losing run, and going, oh, wait a minute, this is getting a little bit tiring now. I'm losing too much. And the fear suddenly comes in. What if I lose all of my money? What if the family and me are homeless by the end of next month? The Excel model doesn't do that, because it's a purely analytical piece of software. And I think as sports bettors, we'd be as analytical as any Excel model would be. Take the emotion out of it and just purely base all of our decisions on whether we're making sound or unreasonable mathematical.
Really solid advice there about being logical and unemotional, because if you look at a lot of bookmaker promotional literature, they often are encouraging you to consider the fact that it matters more if you bet on it, and it feeds into your ego, it feeds into your status as a person, your success or failure rises and falls on the performance of your bets. And I do find, there's nothing like a losing run to sift the wheat from the chaff when it comes on the strong or those prepared to understanding on how to make a profit, because so many people I find just look at the upside. So they might look at a strategy, like let's take your golf strategy. They might look at that and go, look at the profit and loss, look at their ROI from this. But what they're not looking at are those periods of form where you placed several bets during a golf tournament and none of them made a return for you. And then the next week, the same thing happened. And at that stage, that bettor might be having to top up their bookmaker accounts or take more money out of from their bank if they're placing it in the shops. Whatever it might be, there's nothing more unnerving than constantly having to dip into your bankroll or dip into your bank account to top up your bet. So I think that's some fantastic advice, because betting profits just don't come in a straight line, do you? There's not, you haven't got a monthly income and say, yep, I'm going to tell the mortgage company, I'm going to make £2,000, £4,000, whatever it is, every single month. But no, you might make £50,000 over a full year, but it could well be 15,000 in month one, and you lose 2,000 in month two, and so on. So that's some really good information there.
A common thing that I see actually is that every time we have a winner, or maybe two winners in a row on the golf or in quick succession, I find that people start saying, how much should I be betting under my bankroll? And I feel like the answer to that is, if you have to answer that question, you haven't absorbed enough information about the volatility and the variance that is involved here. Because I think what you're looking at is, you're looking at your £2,000 in the bank and thinking, right, I want to be putting £200, £300, £400 on because, we had 125-1 winner last week, 80-1 winner the week before. But you're not seeing the 8-week period where we had only two places and we just lost and lost and lost. And if you're betting at such a level that losing that £2,000 is going to affect you, then you're betting way too high. You need to be betting at a level, dipping your toe in to understand the variance and the volatility. Take it really slowly and bet so small until you're comfortable and you understand what these long losing runs feel like.
No, that's absolutely correct. I always say, you need to walk before you can run. And it doesn't matter if it takes you a couple of years to build up to the stakes that you might be talking about, or stakes where you can make a significant sum of some money. Because the first thing to do is, if you can't make money betting at small stakes, then you'll never make money betting at big stakes. I think that's a very important point to consider. Well, Tom, thank you ever so much for giving us such great insight today in this first podcast. I've got a lot from it. I hope the listeners have too. But for those people who want to find out a little bit more about your service and maybe even get in touch with you, how can they do that?
You can have a listen to the Bashcast podcast, which is available on everybody's favorite podcast provider, except not Spotify or anywhere else other than Apple iTunes. And the website is www.bookiebashing.net.
Fantastic. Well, I absolutely recommend people to go check out your website and to, explore some of the products and tools that you have on there. And thank you again, Tom, for taking the time to be our guest on this podcast.
It's been great fun. Have a good day, Pete.
Thanks for listening to this very latest Smart Betting Club podcast. If you've enjoyed it and are keen to find out more on how the SBC service can help you and your betting, you can save 5% on the cost of membership simply by using the coupon code podcast. Visit smartbettingclub.com, hit subscribe, and enter the coupon code podcast to save 5%.